Having done all this, the king declared as soon as he saw an opportunity that he had never meant to do it, and that it was all illegal, and he got the judges secretly to sign a declaration to that effect. The secret oozed out directly, and was carried to the Duke of Gloucester. The Duke of Gloucester, at the head of 40,000 men, met the king on his entering into London to enforce his authority. The king was helpless against him, his favourites and ministers were impeached and were mercilessly executed. Among them were two men whom the people regarded with very different feelings: one, Robert Tresilian, Chief Justice, who was hated for having made what was called a bloody circuit at Em to try the rioters; the other, Sir Simon Burley, an honourable knight, who had been the dear friend of the Black Prince, and the governor and guardian of the king. For this gentleman at Em's life the good queen even begged of Gloucester on her knees, but Gloucester, with or without reason, feared and hated him, and replied, that if she valued her husband at Em's crown, she had better beg no more. All this was done under what was called by some the Wonderfuller, and by others, with better reason, the Mercilesser Parliament. But Gloucester at Em's power was not to last for ever. He held it for only a year longer, in which year the famous Battle of Otterbourne, sung in the old ballad of Chevy Chase, was fought. When the year was out, the king, turning suddenly to Gloucester, in the midst of a great council, said, "Eh, uncle, how old am I?" "Atm, your highness, atm," returned the duke, "is in your 22nd year. Atm, am I so much?" "Atm," said the king, "eh, then I will manage my own affairs. I am much obliged to you, my good lords, for your past services, but I need them no more." Atm, he followed this up by appointing a new chancellor and a new treasurer, and announced to the people that he had resumed the government. He held it for 8 years without opposition. Through all that time, he kept his determination to revenge himself some day upon his uncle Gloucester, in his own breast. At last the good queen died, and then the king, desiring to take a second wife, proposed to his council that he should marry Isabella, of France, the daughter of Charles VI, who, the French courtiers said, as the English courtiers had said of Richard, was a marvel of beauty and wit, and quite a phenomenon of 7 years old. The council were divided about this marriage, but it took place. It secured peace between England and France for a quarter of a century, but it was strongly opposed to the prejudices of the English people. The Duke of Gloucester, who was anxious to take the occasion of making himself a popular, declaimed against it loudly, and this at length decided the king to execute the vengeance he had been nursing so long. He went with a gay company to the Duke of Gloucester at Em's house, Plessey Castle, in Essex, where the duke, suspecting nothing, came out into the courtyard to receive his royal visitor. While the king conversed in a friendly manner with the duchess, the duke was quietly seized, hurried away, shipped for Calais, and lodged in the castle there. His friends, the Earls of Arundel and Warwick, were taken in the same treacherous manner, and confined to their castles. A few days after, at Nottingham, they were impeached of high treason. The Earl of Arundel was condemned and beheaded, and the Earl of Warwick was banished. Then, a writ was sent by a messenger to the governor of Calais, requiring him to send the Duke of Gloucester over to be tried. In 3 days he returned an answer that he could not do that, because the Duke of Gloucester had died in prison. The duke was declared a traitor. His property was confiscated to the king. A real or pretended confession he had made in prison to one of the justices of the Common Pleas was produced against him, and there was an end of the matter. How the unfortunate duke died, very few cared to know. Whether he really died naturally, whether he killed himself, whether, by the king of Em's order, he was strangled, or smothered between two beds, as a serving man of the governor at Em's named Hall did afterwards declare, cannot be discovered. There is not much doubt that he was killed, somehow or other, by his nephew at Em's orders. Among the most active nobles in these proceedings were the king of Em's cousin, Henry Bolingbroke, whom the king had made Duke of Hereford to smooth down the old family quarrels, and some others, who had in the family plotting times done just such acts themselves as they now condemned in the duke. They seem to have been a corrupt set of men, but such men were easily found about the court in such days. The people murmured at all this, and were still very sore about the French marriage. The nobles saw how little the king cared for law, and how crafty he was, and began to be somewhat afraid for themselves. The king of TMS life was a life of continued feasting and excess. His retinue, down to the meanest servants, were dressed in the most costly manner, and caroused at his tables, it is related, to the number of 10,000 persons every day. He himself, surrounded by a body of 10,000 archers, and enriched by a duty on wool which the commons had granted him for life, saw no danger of ever being otherwise than powerful and absolute, and was as fierce and haughty as a king could be. He had two of his old enemies left, in the persons of the Dukes of Hereford and Norfolk. Sparing these no more than the others, he tampered with the Duke of Hereford until he got him to declare before the council that the Duke of Norfolk had lately held some treasonable talk with him, as he was riding near Brentford, and that he had told him, among other things, that he could not believe the king of TMS Oather, which nobody could, I should think. For this treachery he obtained a pardon, and the Duke of Norfolk was summoned to appear and defend himself. As he denied the charge and said his accuser was a liar and a traitor, both noblemen, according to the manner of those times, were held in custody, and the truth was ordered to be decided by wager of battle at Coventry. This wager of battle meant that whosoever won the combat was to be considered in the right, which nonsense meant in effect, that no strong man could ever be wrong. A great holiday was made, a great crowd assembled, with much parade and show, and the two combatants were about to rush at each other with their lances, when the king, sitting in a pavilion to see fair, threw down the truncheon he carried in his hand, and forbade the battle. The Duke of Hereford was to be banished for 10 years, and the Duke of Norfolk was to be banished for life. So said the king. The Duke of Hereford went to France, and went no farther. The Duke of Norfolk made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and afterwards died at Venice of a broken heart. Faster and fiercer, after this, the king went on in his career. The Duke of Lancaster, who was the father of the Duke of Hereford, died soon after the departure of his son, and, the king, although he had solemnly granted to that son leave to inherit his father a TMS property, if it should come to him during his banishment, immediately seized it all, like a robber. The judges were so afraid of him, that they disgraced themselves by declaring this theft to be just and lawful. His avarice knew no bounds. He outlawed 17 counties at once, on a frivolous pretense, merely to raise money by way of fines for misconduct. In short, he did as many dishonest things as he could, and cared so little for the discontent of his subjects, although even the spaniel favourites began to whisper to him that there was such a thing as discontent afloat, that he took that time, of all others, for leaving England and making an expedition against the Irish. He was scarcely gone, leaving the Duke of York regent in his absence, when his cousin, Henry of Hereford, came over from France to claim the rights of which he had been so monstrously deprived. He was immediately joined by the two great earls of Northumberland and Westmorland, and his uncle, the regent, finding the king of TMS cause unpopular, and the disinclination of the army to act against Henry, very strong, withdrew with the royal forces towards Bristol. Henry, at the head of an army, came from Yorkshire, where he had landed, to London and followed him. They joined their forces, so how they brought that about, is not distinctly understood, and proceeded to Bristol Castle, where the three noblemen had taken the young queen. The castle surrendering, they presently put those three noblemen to death. The regent then remained there, and Henry went on to Chester. All this time, the boisterous weather had prevented the king from receiving intelligence of what had occurred. At length it was conveyed to him in Ireland, and he sent over the Earl of Salisbury, who, landing at Conway, rallied the Welshmen, and waited for the king a whole fortnight. At the end of that time the Welshmen, who were perhaps not very warm for him in the beginning, quite cooled down and went home. When the king did land on the coast at last, he came with a pretty good power, but his men cared nothing for him, and quickly deserted. Supposing the Welshman to be still at Conway, he disguised himself as a priest, and made for that place in company with his two brothers and some few of their adherents. But there were no Welshmen left, only Salisbury and 100 soldiers. In this distress, the King of TMS' two brothers, Exeter and Surrey, offered to go to Henry to learn what his intentions were. Surrey, who was true to Richard, was put into prison. Exeter, who was false, took the royal badge, which was a heart, off his shield, and assumed the rose, the badge of Henry. After this, it was pretty plain to the king what Henry of TMS' intentions were, without sending any more messengers to ask. The fallen king, thus deserted, hemmed in on all sides, and pressed with hunger, rode here and rode there, and went to this castle, and went to that castle, endeavouring to obtain some provisions, but could find none. He rode wretchedly back to Conway, and there surrendered himself to the Earl of Northumberland, who came from Henry, in reality to take him prisoner, but in appearance to offer terms, and whose men were hidden not far off. By this earl he was conducted to the castle of Flint, where his cousin Henry met him, and dropped on his knee as if he were still respectful to his sovereign. "A fair cousin of Lancaster, A.T.M.," said the king, "you are very welcome, A.T.M., very welcome, no doubt, but he would have been more so, in chains or without a head." "Ay, my lord, A.T.M.," replied Henry, "ay, I am come a little before my time, but, with your good pleasure, I will show you the reason. Your people complain with some bitterness, that you have ruled them rigorously for 22 years. Now, if it please God, I will help you to govern them better in future." "A.T.M., a fair cousin, A.T.M.," replied the abject king, "a since it pleaseth you, it pleaseth me mightily." "A.T.M.," after this, the trumpets sounded, and the king was stuck on a wretched horse, and carried prisoner to Chester, where he was made to issue a proclamation, calling a parliament. From Chester he was taken on towards London. At Lichfield he tried to escape by getting out of a window and letting himself down into a garden. It was all in vain, however, and he was carried on and shut up in the Tower, where no one pitied him, and where the whole people, whose patience he had quite tired out, reproached him without mercy. Before he got there, it is related, that his very dog left him and departed from his side to lick the hand of Henry. The day before the Parliament met, a deputation went to this wrecked king, and told him that he had promised the Earl of Northumberland at Conway Castle to resign the crown. He said he was quite ready to do it, and signed a paper in which he renounced his authority and absolved his people from their allegiance to him. He had so little spirit left that he gave his royal ring to his triumphant cousin Henry with his own hand, and said, that if he could have had leave to appoint a successor, that same Henry was the man of all others whom he would have named. Next day, the Parliament assembled in Westminster Hall, where Henry sat at the side of the throne, which was empty and covered with a cloth of gold. The paper just signed by the king was read to the multitude amid shouts of joy, which were echoed through all the streets. When some of the noise had died away, the king was formally deposed. Then Henry arose, and, making the sign of the cross on his forehead and breast, challenged the realm of England as his right. The archbishops of Canterbury and York seated him on the throne. The multitude shouted again, and the shouts re-echoed throughout all the streets. No one remembered, now, that Richard II had ever been the most beautiful, the wisest, and the best of princes, and he now made living, to my thinking, a far more sorry spectacle in the Tower of London, than what Tyler had made, lying dead, among the hoofs of the royal horses in Smithfield. The poll tax died with what? The Smiths to the king and royal family, could make no chains in which the king could hang the people TMS recollection of him, so the poll tax was never collected. Chapter 6: England under Henry IV, Coldbling broke, during the last reign. The preaching of Wycliffe against the pride and cunning of the Pope and all his men, had made a great noise in England. Whether the new king wished to be in favour with the priests, or whether he hoped, by pretending to be very religious, to cheat heaven itself into the belief that he was not a usurper, I don't yet know. Both suppositions are likely enough. It is certain that he began his reign by making a strong show against the followers of Wycliffe, who were called Lollards, or heretics who, although his father, John of Gaunt, had been of that way of thinking, as he himself had been more than suspected of being, it is no less certain that he first established in England the detestable and atrocious custom, brought from abroad, of burning those people as a punishment for their opinions. It was the importation into England of one of the practices of what was called the Holy Inquisition, which was the most unholy and the most infamous tribunal that ever disgraced mankind, and made men more like demons than followers of our Saviour. No real right to the crown, as you know, was in this king. Edward Mortimer, the young Earl of Marcher, who was only 8 or 9 years old, and who was descended from the Duke of Clarence, the elder brother of Henry at EMS father, was, by succession, the real heir to the throne. However, the king got his son declared Prince of Wales, and, obtaining possession of the young Earl of March and his little brother, kept them in confinement, but not severely, in Windsor Castle. He then required the Parliament to decide what was to be done with the deposed king, who was quiet enough, and who only said that he hoped his cousin Henry would be a good lord at EM to him. The Parliament replied that they would recommend his being kept in some secret place where the people could not resort, and where his friends could not be admitted to see him. Henry accordingly passed this sentence upon him, and it now began to be pretty clear to the nation that Richard II would not live very long. It was a noisy Parliament, as it was an unprincipled one, and the Lords quarrelled so violently among themselves as to which of them had been loyal and which disloyal, and which consistent and which inconsistent, that 40 gauntlets are said to have been thrown upon the floor at one time as challenges to as many battles, the truth being that they were all false and base together, and had been, at one time with the old king, and at another time with the new one, and seldom true for any length of time to any one. They soon began to plot again. A conspiracy was formed to invite the king to a tournament at Oxford, and then to take him by surprise and kill him. This murderous enterprise, which was agreed upon at secret meetings in the house of the Abbot of Westminster, was betrayed by the Earl of Rutland, one of the conspirators. The king, instead of going to the tournament or staying at Windsor, where the conspirators suddenly went, on finding themselves discovered, with the hope of seizing him, retired to London, proclaimed them all traitors, and advanced upon them with a great force. They retired into the west of England, proclaiming Richard king, but the people rose against them, and they were all slain. Their treason hastened the death of the deposed monarch. Whether he was killed by hired assassins, or whether he was starved to death, or whether he refused food on hearing of his brothers being killed, who were in that plot, is very doubtful. He met his death somehow, and his body was publicly shown at St. Paul at EMS Cathedral with only the lower part of the face uncovered. I can scarcely doubt that he was killed by the king at EMS orders. The French wife of the miserable Richard was now only 10 years old, and, when her father, Charles of France, heard of her misfortunes and of her lonely condition in England, he went mad, as he had several times done before, during the last 5 or 6 years. The French dukes of Burgundy and Bourbon took up the poor girl at EMS cause, without caring much about it, but on the chance of getting something out of England. The people of Bordeaux, who had a sort of superstitious attachment to the memory of Richard, because he was born there, swore by the Lord that he had been the best man in all his kingdom, which was going rather far, and promised to do great things against the English. Nevertheless, when they came to consider that they, and the whole people of France, were ruined by their own nobles, and that the English rule was much the better of the two, they cooled down again, and the two dukes, although they were very great men, could do nothing without them. Then began negotiations between France and England for the sending home to Paris of the poor little queen with all her jewels and her fortune of 200,000 francs in gold. The king was quite willing to restore the young lady, and even the jewels, but he said he really could not part with the money. So, at last she was safely deposited at Paris without her fortune, and then the Duke of Burgundy, who was cousin to the French king, began to quarrel with the Duke of Orleans, who was brother to the French king, about the whole matter, and those two dukes made France even more wretched than ever. As the idea of conquering Scotland was still popular at home, the king marched to the River Tyne and demanded homage of the king of that country. This being refused, he advanced to Edinburgh, but did little there, for, his army being in want of provisions, and the Scotch being very careful to hold him in check without giving battle, he was obliged to retire. It is to his immortal honour that in this sally he burnt no villages and slaughtered no people, but was particularly careful that his army should be merciful and harmless. It was a great example in those ruthless times. A war among the border people of England and Scotland went on for 12 months, and then the Earl of Northumberland, the nobleman who had helped Henry to the crown, began to rebel against him, probably because nothing that Henry could do for him would satisfy his extravagant expectations. There was a certain Welsh gentleman, named Owen Glendower, who had been a student in one of the inns of court, and had afterwards been in the service of the late king, whose Welsh property was taken from him by a powerful lord related to the present king, who was his neighbour. Appealing for redress, and getting none, he took up arms, was made an outlaw, and declared himself sovereign of Wales. He pretended to be a magician, and not only were the Welsh people stupid enough to believe him, but even Henry believed him too, for, making 3 expeditions into Wales, and being 3 times driven back by the wildness of the country, the bad weather, and the skill of Glendower, he thought he was defeated by the Welshmen at EMS Magic Arts. However, he took Claude Grey and Sir Edmund Mortimer, prisoners, and allowed the relatives of Lord Grey to ransom him, but would not extend such favour to Sir Edmund Mortimer. Now, Henry Percy, called Hotspur, son of the Earl of Northumberland, who was married to Mortimer at EMS sister, is supposed to have taken offence at this, and, therefore, in conjunction with his father and some others, to have joined Owen Glendower, and risen against Henry. It is by no means clear that this was the real cause of the conspiracy, but perhaps it was made the pretext. It was formed, and was very powerful, including Scroope, Archbishop of York, and the Earl of Douglas, a powerful and brave Scottish nobleman. The king was prompt and active, and the two armies met at Shrewsbury. There were about 14,000 men in each. The old Earl of Northumberland being sick, the rebel forces were led by his son. The king wore plain armour to deceive the enemy, and 4 noblemen, with the same object, wore the royal arms. The rebel charge was so furious that every one of those gentlemen was killed, the royal standard was beaten down, and the young Prince of Wales was severely wounded in the face. But he was one of the bravest and best soldiers that ever lived, and he fought so well, and the King of TMS troops were so encouraged by his bold example, that they rallied immediately, and cut the enemy TMS forces all to pieces. Hotspur was killed by an arrow in the brain, and the rout was so complete that the whole rebellion was struck down by this one blow. The Earl of Northumberland surrendered himself soon after hearing of the death of his son, and received a pardon for all his offences. There were some lingerings of rebellion yet, Owen Glendower being retired to Wales, and a preposterous story being spread among the ignorant people that King Richard was still alive. How they could have believed such nonsense it is difficult to imagine, but they certainly did suppose that the court fool of the late king, who was something like him, was he, himself, so that it seemed as if, after giving so much trouble to the country in his life, he was still to trouble it after his death. This was not the worst. The young Earl of March and his brother were stolen out of Windsor Castle, being retaken, and being found to have been spirited away by one Lady Spencer, she accused her own brother, the Earl of Rutland, who was in the former conspiracy and was now Duke of York, of being in the plot. For this he was ruined in fortune, though not put to death, and then another plot arose among the old Earl of Northumberland, some other lords, and that same Scroope, Archbishop of York, who was with the rebels before. These conspirators caused a writing to be posted on the church doors, accusing the king of a variety of crimes, but, the king being eager and vigilant to oppose them, they were all taken, and the archbishop was executed. This was the first time that a great churchman had been slain by the law in England, but the king was resolved that it should be done, and done it was. The next most remarkable event of this time was the seizure, by Henry, of the heir to the Scottish throne, James, a boy of 9 years old. He had been put aboard ship by his father, the Scottish King Robert, to save him from the designs of his uncle, when, on his way to France, he was accidentally taken by some English cruisers. He remained a prisoner in England for 19 years, and became in his prison a student and a famous poet. With the exception of occasional troubles with the Welsh and with the French, the rest of King Henry's reign was quiet enough. But, the king was far from happy, and probably was troubled in his conscience by knowing that he had usurped the crown, and had occasioned the death of his miserable cousin. The Prince of Wales, though brave and generous, is said to have been wild and dissipated, and even to have drawn his sword on Gascoigne, the Chief Justice of the King's bench, because he was firm in dealing impartially with one of his dissolute companions. Upon this the Chief Justice is said to have ordered him immediately to prison, the Prince of Wales is said to have submitted with a good grace, and the King is said to have exclaimed, "A happy is the monarch who has so just a judge, and a son so willing to obey the laws." Atm. This is all very doubtful, and so is another story, of which Shakespeare has made beautiful use, that the prince once took the crown out of his father at Atm's chamber as he was sleeping, and tried it on his own head. The King's health sank more and more, and he became subject to violent eruptions on the face and to bad epileptic fits, and his spirits sank every day. At last, as he was praying before the shrine of St. Edward at Westminster Abbey, he was seized with a terrible fit, and was carried into the Abbot's chamber, where he presently died. It had been foretold that he would die at Jerusalem, which certainly is not, and never was, Westminster. But, as the Abbot's room had long been called the Jerusalem chamber, people said it was all the same thing, and were quite satisfied with the prediction. The king died on the 20th of March, 1413, in the 47th year of his age, and the 14th of his reign. He was buried in Canterbury Cathedral. He had been twice married, and had, by his first wife, a family of 4 sons and 2 daughters. Considering his duplicity before he came to the throne, his unjust seizure of it, and above all, his making that monstrous law for the burning of what the priests called heretics, he was a reasonably good king, as kings went. Chapter 6. England under Henry V. First Part. The Prince of Wales began his reign like a generous and honest man. He set the young Earl of March free. He restored their estates and their honours to the Percy family, who had lost them by their rebellion against his father. He ordered the imbecile and unfortunate Richard to be honourably buried among the kings of England, and he dismissed all his wild companions, with assurances that they should not want, if they would resolve to be steady, faithful, and true. It is much easier to burn men than to burn their opinions, and those of the Lollards were spreading every day. The Lollards were represented by the press so probably falsely for the most part to entertain reasonable designs against the new king, and Henry, suffering himself to be worked upon by these representations, sacrificed his friend Sir John Oldcastle, the Lord Cobham, to them, after trying in vain to convert him by arguments. He was declared guilty, as the head of the sect, and sentenced to the flames, but he escaped from the Tower before the day of execution, postponed for 50 days by the king himself, and summoned the Lollards to meet him near London on a certain day. So the priests told the king, at least. I doubt whether there was any conspiracy beyond such as was got up by their agents. On the day appointed, instead of 25,000 men, under the command of Sir John Oldcastle, in the meadows of St. Giles, the king found only 80 men, and no Sir John at all. There was, in another place, an addle-headed brewer, who had gold trappings to his horses, and a pair of gilt spurs in his breast, who expecting to be made a knight next day by Sir John, and so to gain the right to wear thimble. But there was no Sir John, nor did anybody give information respecting him, though the king offered great rewards for such intelligence. 30 of these unfortunate lollards were hanged and drawn immediately, and were then burned, gallows and all, and the various prisons in and around London were crammed full of others.